Beleza? Eu penso que nós temos duas perguntas, né? Que o próprio professor Luciano colocou aí para o professor Grego e para o professor Lutina. E eu acho que também temos um tempo aí para entender algumas perguntas da plateia e passar então para um momento de debate. Sim, penso sim, né? Questões que ficaram. Pode ser até falando agora, então talvez fosse até o caso de convidar os apresentadores dessa manhã para também participarem dessa mesa, professor Braga, professor Paulo. A plateia os está convocando, porque as perguntas serão feitas para todos. Então, acho que já, se alguém já tiver alguma pergunta.
Se é esse o caso, você vai
acabar.
Fazendo tudo no final.
Posso fazer a sugestão? O professor Gordinho fez perguntas específicas sobre a economia americana e perguntas importantes. Cadê o Augusto?
Está aqui.
Augusto. Eu sugeriria que isso fosse feito, a resposta de ambos, fazemos um intervalo e depois.
Ótimo. Então, acho que seria bom se o professor Gutman viesse aqui também, pessoal.
Progressive nature nature of the intertextual form, and therefore it decimates the automatic stabilizers and built into the system. So that's a really bad idea. When it comes to corporate intertextual form, that's an incredibly complicated question, and it's tied to also the whole question of bringing back cash. The US companies are harboring between $2 and $3 trillion abroad, with tax shelter reasons, that they ought to bring back, right, and then deploy. And this involves an amnesty that's tied to the kind of corporate tax reform. But what's important is we have a 35% supposed tax rate, but most of the companies pay less than 12% because of the deductions. You have to understand that our tax system is a huge subsidy machine, right? And the worst part of this, and this is I think where I really have a problem, and that gets me back also into the infrastructure spending, is the infrastructure is very traditional, right? It's not a modern infrastructure investment spending, right? What we need is infrastructure spending towards climate change mitigation and adaptation, right? So you would have infrastructure into smart electricity grids, for example, right? Infrastructure into better urban planning rather than urban sprawl, right? There's a reason why Atlanta has 10 times the per capita carbon footprint than Barcelona, and it's going to get wider because he privileges cars, fossil fuels, coal. I mean, his biggest thing is to bring coal back, right? And his biggest marginal victory was in West Virginia, which is the heart of coal. So this is like a 19th century, you know, fossil fuel age kind of vision that is totally not only like obsolete, but it's dangerous in terms of destroying one of the great legacies of Obama, which is the Paris Agreement, which he wants to destroy. So the devil is in the details. And those are political battles to be had. And you know, building a Keystone pipeline as an infrastructure investment is not a good idea. But infrastructure investments are incredibly important. And they're also growth promoting, they have good multiplier effects. So I don't want to come across to say no, go to infrastructure investments. I think they're important, but which kinds are crucial, right? And then finally, it is tied to the monetary policy and the tapering off and how that coincides. And he's going to have a huge fight and he's going to sack Janet Yellen, and that's not going to be an easy thing to do because the Fed is supposed to be independent. Janet Yellen and the Fed currently is quite leftist. And so there's going to be a huge fight that will create a confidence crisis for the dollar, which there'll be other reasons, right? Then the question is, how does that spill over to the rest of the world? Right? And the financing by the rest of the world of American deficits. What's not only the infrastructure within the US, but the infrastructure, globally speaking, between the dollar and the rest of the world, right? Still being stuck in quantitative easing. So it's a pretty complex situation. I hope I gave some kind of reasonable answer.
No, I give a very simple answer, is that there is no appetite at all in Congress for any sort of deficit spending. That's the first part. The second part is that on December 9th,
you
got to
speak up.
Oh, sorry. On December 9th, the Congress has to deal with the fact that the continuing resolution to fund the government expires. So it may be that the government gets shut down on December 9th. And I think this will be a very interesting exercise because it will show just exactly what the current Republican congressional majority is willing or is not willing to accept in terms of deviation from what is their pure fundamental principle that the government should always be smaller rather than be larger. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part is that Republican Congresses never reject tax reductions, so that it's highly probable that what eventually gets proposed in terms of tax reduction, there will be something. The problem with tax rates is that they start The interesting thing is that both the carried interest and the corporate tax really are, what should I say, the corporate tax is really not a reduction, because this is not tax that ever would have been, the 35% is not tax that ever would have been paid anyway. Now, the point is that if the tax is reduced, it's going to have to be reduced below what is the current effective rate. And I don't know, Robbie is better informed than I am what the average rate is. I do know that for some corporations, the rate is below 5%. So if this is going to be a revenue raiser, the rate that is going to encourage corporations to bring their funds back will be less than 5%, which means that it's a really very marginal proposition. The last time a proposal like this was made, there were requirements made on firms that they would have to underpay certain expenditures of those funds. And in fact, more or less, it never happened. Virtually, there was no monitoring at all, and the firms never did. So bringing the money back really is not providing any impetus for firms to expand expenditures in the United States. And if you look at the percentage, it's basically the reason they're overseas. It's not because of the tax rate, it's because they don't have anything to do with it. Apple has no idea what to do with its money aside from giving it back to the shareholders. So on those principles, we would say, yeah, we will get some sort of tax reduction. You will get probably de facto an increase in the deficit, which the Congress will insist that it did not approve, but it did approve the tax reductions that created it, and this will be the subterfuge of which it takes place. On the part of the infrastructure investments, yeah, these are also investments that probably, I think, will be approved. The question is how they get financed. Now, the United States does not have currently a development bank or any sort of mechanism by which these things could be financed, but there are a number of proposals that are currently on the table, and the problem is that these proposals finance the infrastructure spending without increasing the deficit. It's the basic condition for doing that. So the likelihood is, yes, you'll get an increase in spending, but somehow or other, there will be an offset. It will either be done through private or through these very strange.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. One might be under the angle of backwards. The development bank that is one that privatizes a bunch of very public things like roads, which would be disastrous. So there's going to be a good battle over that. The other thing that's important is the corporate tax reform is sort of on the 15%. And then give an amnesty for the money coming back, which wouldn't be taxed at all. And so in that sense, it can bring money back. But most of this, as you will say, will end up in share buybacks and dividend payouts rather than productive investments. Because many of the corporations are in an overproduction position, right? And so they don't want capacity expansion, and he can now create the kind of jobs that he promised them that he would be able to create, right? Because he's not the person who's investing in new plants. Right? He can just give incentives above borders. You should have probably explained a little bit about the carried interest, what that is, right? Mm-hmm. The tax provision, which is a currently, fund managers, in particular hedge fund managers, which are superstars on Wall Street and billionaires, but also other types of fund managers, leverage buyers, and so forth, they get all of their income taxed as capital gains. And as such, they get all of their income taxed as capital gains, they get their money taxed much less than anybody else, right? So the richest people in America who are in the financial sector, who are the superstars of finance, get taxed less than anybody else. And that creates a lot of fury among exactly the people that voted for him. Because one of the key targets of the anger that drove him to victory is against banks. But he's not going to touch the banks. I mean, he may make some adjustments to Dodd-Frank. that he can sort of say that these are the worst bankers and I'm going to sacrifice them by normalizing the tax rate. They're still going to be super rich, right? He's just going to tax them instead of 15%, he's going to tax them, you know, a little bit more. But in his tax proposal, the effective rate that he proposes on the top would actually tax those guys as less, as little as now. So his current interest payment tax plan doesn't make any sense, because even if he installs it, they would still end up paying much less, because they would get the biggest tax base from the other concession that he makes. Right? So there is no effective tax increase for the very rich in place, not even for the hedge fund managers. But I also think that, you know, while I appreciate the fact that you have some kind of thirst for some moment of optimism, the rest of the news around Trump is so bad that this will be dwarfed by the disaster that awaits.
Então, eu sugeriria que, eu acho que a gente ainda tem um pouquinho mais de tempo, se tivéssemos mais perguntas relacionadas a esse tema, que elas fossem feitas agora, e que então, perguntas sobre a percepção do professor Braga, que sejam feitas depois da última rodada, quando ele estará aqui de novo, então, apropriado para a técnica.
Or the threat of acquisition.
sharing economy, which you notice is in a term that I did not use, because normally sharing does not include a financial transaction, only sharing things are providing equally amongst people. It is a little different because you're not actually acquiring a small tax income. What you say is that I recognize that there is an intermediation profit that associates with intermediation in these companies that can be eliminated by means of using an alternative organization of the business. Okay. Now, whether this is truly a difference is unclear. Substantial portion of my life in Italy, Italian cooperative taxi drivers had a system which was very similar to the Uber system, except that they rented themselves, and they rented by means of what was then called a CB radio. Okay, so effectively, it's exactly the same thing. The intermediation profit accrued to the taxi drivers because they were cooperative, and they had one girl who sat with the radio, and when you got the taxi, you called up, and the girl would send you the taxi. So it's simply a question of technology. So in the present case, what they're saying is that if you look at the technology does allow for direct exchange of information. Okay, you have the rider who needs to ride, and you have the cab driver who has the cab and has the supply. And the question is, how do you bring that supply and demand together? Now, in most markets, supply and demand are brought together by means of some middleman, some intermediation, or some market maker. Okay? There's only one case in which this doesn't happen, and this is the case of the coal raising coal market, in which there is no market maker that takes a cut between the bid and the ask price. So basically, what you're saying is that the taxi company that works on the basis of a margin, bid-ask margin. And then bid-ask margin is what the owner of the cab company uses to provide the taxi cab, to provide the overheads, and to do the organization. Okay? Now, that is a profit that technically need not exist if you can bring the buyer and the seller together. So what we did is to say, okay, what I'm going to do is to create a system which I'm going to sell that technology. Okay? And I'm going to sell that technology to the cab driver, because the cab driver has to sign up to get access to the Uber system. And I'm then going to give that technology to the driver. So what happens is the two connect directly. Okay? And that intermediation profit disappears. But part of it goes to Uber, part of it probably does disappear. The other side of the story is that for the cab driver, the way the thing is presented, the cab driver gets to decide his own timetable as to work when he wants to work. Traditionally, for New York cab drivers, you have to work shifts. Very regulated, so you can't decide to work in any of whatever. So that is supposed to benefit. Now, the difficulty was that Uber, in order to get itself off the ground, okay, did what? It started to compress the fares that the cab drivers could charge. So the income of the cab drivers went down, the income of the owners disappeared because it was displaced by the system of technology. So that's the first impact. Okay, this is why is this value extraction? Given the new technology, there is value here that no longer needs to exist. If I had one single system of allocating cabs between all the cab drivers and all the workers, then I would not need any intermediation function. Yes, there is a decrease in income.
whether or not Uber is going to be able to generate actually realize that it's a problem until now, because Uber does not only concentrate on providing cab rides, and they also require substantial expenses in order to launch the system, and in fact to overcome regulatory problems, because basically if you go to New York City and you get into a regulated taxi cab, a regulated driver has gone through a regulated safety assessment and test and a whole bunch of other things, which Uber drivers don't have to go through. And the question is whether they should do that. So we're fighting for and this is one of the reasons why, despite the fact that they have managed to attract very large investment funds, they have still not generated. So basically what has happened so far is that you reduce the incomes of the competitive cap companies, you reduce the incomes of the cap companies, and Uber has not yet managed to appropriate any of that value, which I hope to appropriate. Now, presumably, this is the reason why they have all of these investors. The investors eventually see this as the only possible. And obviously, once they do obtain office, it means that they will have control over the prices and control over the margins, and presumably they will then be able to set the prices so that they do generate. Just for the last level, my problem here really is the small and medium-sized business and middle-class incomes, who generally tend to have relatively high propensities to consume, whereas the shareholders of Uber and people who are running Uber generally do not have a very high propensity to consume. So that not only do you destroy the income, but you also specification of the value of the multiplier is you end up reducing the value of the overall multiplier by doing this. So basically it's something that on the outside it looks like a very reasonable proposition and gain a great deal of support. Finally there has been some resistance in terms of the labor departments. And say, look, I can get health insurance, I work already free time, I don't have any of the normal protection that contract labor would have. And effectively, I am a contract worker, despite the fact that Uber doesn't give me a contract, as opposed to an independent contractor. And if that eventually does happen, then Uber is going to have to provide the normal contractual labor benefits, and who knows if the thing is in fact viable.
Can I just add one?
Yeah.
Actually, Uber has been obliged by the British government to do exactly that, to provide normal labor protections. And this is a crucial question about how the sharing of gig economy will deal with labor in the future, right? As independent contractors, workers have no protections and no benefits. The only thing that they have as independent contractors is that they have flexibility of the work time, but that given that they're low paid, the flexibility is a very questionable flexibility, because when you're low paid, you have to work a lot of hours. But the other thing that you provide, which is interesting, but I wouldn't therefore make this connection between the leverage dialogue of the 80s and the new creative destroyers, the cyberspace. I think that, and this started already with the dot-com web bubble in the late 90s, cyberspace companies have a different kind of life cycle evaluation function or constraint than other companies, right? And in that sense, the cyber economy is very, very different in terms of financing, corporate structure, etc. Right? And so Uber, for example,
the fact that it has drawn profit is not necessarily a sign of its lack of success, because it has had to set up a pretty expensive infrastructure, and it did it very rapidly on a completely global scale. I mean, I remember that when my 20-year-old daughter went to Beijing, the first thing she was doing, she was driving around in Uber cabs, right? And the equivalent, not anymore, right?
Not anymore.
Right. But China is definitely equivalent, right? And so, the more important point here is that we can look at a growing number of sectors and see this disruption. And this will also hit us, Jan, because once you have online education, work better than MOOCs with a different kind of incentive schemes and accredited certifications that are as good as our diplomas, then our good colleges are going to die also, right? And so I think one of the questions we have to figure out is what kind of heterodox analysis in industrial economics do you provide for cyberspace, which is quite different. And the leveraged buyouts that you were talking about, right? To me, the shareholder value maximization, and you accepted that for a moment, right, came in response to that. Because for every leveraged buyout that you described, where companies basically get dismantled, there were four or five that were not leveraged buyouts, where the companies responded and paid off, and then got the success of the institutional investors. And the deal was between the managers and the institutional investors to fend off the raiders. And that's where the shareholder value maximization deal was made. Right? Not for the leveraged buyouts, not for the corporate raiders, but in response to them.
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make.
Right. Okay. So we agree on that.
No, I wasn't saying that it didn't exist. I was saying that this wasn't something that sort of.
Right.
Because it's very interesting. First deals with Unicap, which was, if I remember, Boone Pickens. Boone Pickens or Carlisle?
Boone
Pickens. Anyway, the response to this that came from the industry organizations, there was a trade association for 4 years, it was a very interesting statement. They said, well, we are responsible to our stakeholders. And it was written very clearly. We're responsible for our workers, we're responsible for our shareholders, and all of this goes against all of that. Okay? It took about 6 to 9 months that all of that disappeared. And then nobody worried any longer about stakeholders or shareholders or anybody else. And I said, it was all in terms of corporate efficiency. How could I turn how could you put corporations in this? Lean profit generating machine. Now, they were not interested in that at all. All they were interested in was putting out the value. It was only subsequently that these sorts of things started to work. And then, Jensen and all these people came along and said, well, if you maximize shareholder value, really what you need is to align the incentives of management with the incentives of the stockholders, so let's do stock options. And that's when stock options. But this came, as I said, it came relatively late after the sufficient number of shareholders had seen themselves being, because when it starts out, you go to the shareholders and you offer them a buyout. Okay? And the buyout is going to be substantially above what the market price is. But if you choose not to sell, then basically, you lost your bottom line. Pretty much, I would think that it was a big.
Não entendeu? Você está com dificuldade para falar.
Não.
Você entendeu? Você está. Já não entendo inglês.
Boa.
Às 5 horas, é a sessão de encerramento do seminário. Muito obrigada a todos.